Hello, this is Susan Grappi, the editor-in-chief of Strange Horizons, welcoming you back for part two of our podcast interview with Ben Rosenbaum. Part two really just picks up where part one left off, and it only left off because I was having some computer trouble. Where we did leave off, I believe Ben was explaining what benefits he gets out of making his work available through Creative Commons licenses and the joys of allowing other people to remix or rework stories of his.
Which is good. Right. And I think that, you know, people get scared off by that kind of thing because of the financial considerations, which, you know, for some people may be reasonable. I mean, I'm not sort of claiming that everyone would, you know, always make more money if they did things in Creative Commons. You know, every strategy needs, you know, business matters need to be tailored, you know, to your particular situation. But for me, that's kind of a secondary thing. You know, that's kind of like, you know, first people should play with my stuff. And then, you know, if they're making money, you know, I mean, like, you know, so sure, there's some, at some point, if there's money involved, then you have to figure out something that's fair and whatnot. But, you know, that's, it seems like that comes second, particularly with short fiction. You're not, you know, nobody's making a lot of money on short fiction anyway. And I think science fiction, I think that science fiction, because it has a pulp history, well, I think that there's a, you know, and again, I'm not running down anybody's right to make their own decision regarding their own work. But I think that there's a kind of a bravado, which is understandable given science fiction's history as a ghetto genre, where, you know, it was spurned by the literary establishment and you know, basically being told, you know, oh, you're just doing this for the money. And so you get a lot of kind of anecdotes from you know, people who were, back when 3 cents a word was money, you know, man, I can make 3 cents a word, you know, which is, I don't know, the 30s to the 50s or something. You know, there's a lot of people who were kind of like, you know, they would just churn out hundreds of thousands of words, you know, some of which, you know, was actually probably not bad. I mean, a lot of people, I think, were, you know, have done good art in that mode. I'm a big fan of Philip K. Dick, and I think he, you know, never paused his typewriter, you know. It's not that that was necessarily bad, but there was, I think there's a holdover of that where people are a little bit like, you know, diminish the playfulness of, like, the fact that, you know, I mean, there's a way in which, particularly with short fiction, it's like, come on, who are we kidding? This isn't that much money. No, let's just have fun.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting on the...
I must say that it hasn't, I certainly don't think it's hurt, if anything, I think Creative Commonsing things has tended to get them out there more. They get more recognition. They get more reprints. I have never seen a case. I've had lots of stories that I've released Creative Commons. Everyone can read them on the web, and then, like, lots of people buy them to reprint them in anthologies.
Yeah,
which makes sense to me. If you're putting together an anthology, you want that story in it. You know, you don't. It's not really relevant that somebody can go download it on one of the billion sites on the web. You know, so I've never seen it. I'm not aware of any case where someone was discouraged from paying me for a reprint by the fact that something was already available in Creative Commons.
Right. So. Yeah. It's interesting the way, and also the feeling that it encourages kind of collaboration, because I also, something I noticed looking through your bibliography, but also conversations you and I have had about writing projects that you're currently working on, you seem to really thrive with the sort of collaboration. I don't know if this is true for most writers, but it certainly seems to be true for you.
In a way, I have a love-hate relationship with collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, because I'm an extrovert, and so, I mean, you know, that's... that makes writing hard, actually. It's there's something really fun about collaboration because it's like writing, except you're with people.
Right.
So, you know, so, and there's a way in which collaborations are always, I mean, I've gotten to collaborate with really, really fun people. And it's always really exciting because the great thing about it is whenever you get sort of frustrated or stuck, you can kind of throw it over the wall to your collaborator and they have more energy, you know. So it's very motivating, too, to not have to sort of, I mean, you know, there's a, I'm very motivated in writing by the fact that somebody's going to see this. You know, I the whole sort of Emily Dickinson, you know, romantic model of I'm just writing for the ages, and, you know, if I publish it, that's secondary. Well, I mean, I really, you know, I sort of feel like, well, maybe I should feel like that, but I actually feel like it is a communication, and unless I sort of feel like stories that I wrote that I ended up, you know, not publishing, they died, they're dead. Stories that I published, they're alive, like people are reading them. You know, it doesn't. Perhaps this is because I'm an extrovert, but it doesn't really feel like, you know, the writing, the composition was the primary thing, and then, you know, might get published or not.
Joining that dialogue that you were talking about is what's important, sort of getting the story out there and talking to people.
Exactly. The dialogue is really important for me. And I also have a very, what's the word for that? I have a very low, you know, I guess I'm not really great with delayed gratification. So in this regard, in many realms of my life, I'm fine with delayed gratification. But, you know, I'm just a little bit, short stories are addictive because, you can finish them in a relatively short period of time and then you get them out there and then people are reading them. And collaborations are even more so because, heck, you just have to write a little bit of it and then you can show it to your collaborator. So they're very, but I mean, the reason I say it's a love-hate relationship is that there's always a point in a collaboration where you're like, trying to align the visions and where you're like, this would be so much easier if I could just do it, get away from the key. And from my birth, and you kind of have to sort of muster I wouldn't say that happens to every collaboration, but it's very common. Even in great collaborations where you really have a great process and you really love the person's ideas and everything, there's usually a point where you're like, let me just do it, I think part of the benefit of collaboration is, that sometimes you get to really interesting places by letting go of that, you have to get to some third alternative. But I also had a novel that I wrote collaboratively, which died, which kind of I'm a little bit scarred by, because it was sort of like, we actually managed to finish it to first draft and whatever, but it was such an art, and it was a great process. And my co-writer is a great guy, and it was really fun to write with him. And I learned a lot, but it was unwieldy, to write a novel that way. I didn't have the skills for it. And so it was hard. Some of those stories from it, actually, there's some stories that are taken from it, which actually are one of them's coming out in fantasy and science fiction soon, and the other one's coming out in Realms of Fantasy soon. So there were some results from it, it ended up not cohering as a novel, and that's very hard for me, losing, right. Because that's one of the things that's scary about novels, and it's easier about short stories, is I sort of feel like at this stage in my competency as a writer, like, I know I can get a short story done. If I started, I know I can get it done, it's not 100% guaranteed that it'll sell, but it's sort of like, it seems like a doable project, whereas I'm still very scared. I'm trying to work my way through novels, and, I'm working on one novel in the foreground, kinda, although it's been a little bit pushed to the side by all these collaborations. But anyway, one novel I'm kind of working on the foreground, and a couple of them I'm working on in the background, but they're much harder because they're alone and they're so long term, and there's such risk because I'm not at the stage of competency where I know I can, like, okay, I know what I know. Oh, that'll be 6 months and I'll have the novel done. I segued from collaborations to length.
No, that's right. I'm trying to think if I can have some sort of, graceful segue into talking about something else. But instead, let's just say back to my list of things I wanted to talk to you about, which is you have just recently moved back to Switzerland.
Yes.
And I think there is something I think kind of unusual about the fact that you and your family keep moving continents. and I was wondering if, how are you liking Switzerland? Because you've lived there before. This isn't your first time.
I have. This is my, fourth sojourn in Switzerland. It sort of depends on how you count.
Right.
Since my oscillation between continents started out as a long-distance relationship. My wife and I met when we were, my junior year abroad in 17 years ago in 1990 in Siena, Italy. And, we keep bopping back and forth. And there were longer and longer kind of sojourns in different places. And so in some ways I'm much better adapted to life in Switzerland. The first full year that I lived in Switzerland back in the mid 90s was incredibly hard. It was really like a really hard year because I was so culturally isolated. And you don't think of the culture, it's not like I've moved to, Swaziland instead of Switzerland. They're almost spelled the same, but that you would figure, I've never been to Swaziland, but you would figure that would be a bigger cultural jump. Switzerland and America, they don't seem that different, but in fact, subtle cultural difference, it's kind of magnified as you stay there longer and longer. And particularly, I was very immersed. I didn't know any English speakers. I was, I just was hanging out with all my wife's friends, and I was dunked into German. And so, Swiss German, which is not written dialect with no regular orthography. It's like 18th century English.
Really?
So, well, it's actually a lot like 18th century German. But anyway, so at this point, I've adapted a lot. I sort of know the drill. And what's interesting is I feel like in a different culture, you acquire a different self. And it's a painful process because you're, my American self kind of didn't really work that well in Switzerland. I'm a sort of pushy intellectual East Coast Jew. I have a habit of interrupting people when I get excited, and it's like, there's a lot of conversational mannerisms and ways of looking at things. I would tell jokes that in America would be funny, and in Switzerland we're just greeted with expressions of horror, They have much less kind of resistance against violence because there isn't that much, you know, this sort of American kind of gallows humor thing. You know, there's a lot of jokes about a lot of jokes in America which involve, you know, some degree of violence or you know, kind of abusive dark side to them, and that's kind of the kick. That's the edge in the humor. This doesn't really work in Switzerland. People are like, at least in my, you know, circle of acquaintances, people are like, oh my god, you didn't just say that. So I kind of had to. And it was a process of initially creating kind of a second Swiss self, like a shell, like, okay, let me pretend to act the way I would if I were Swiss. And that was very distancing from people because the first American self would just like drive people nuts. And then the second, you know, Swiss self, they were fine, but I was like, I felt like I wasn't here, you know, I was playing this role. And I kind of had to create a happy medium. And I kind of had to decide, okay, here's a place where I can let it go and act the Swiss way, and that's going to work out because it's not really a problem. And actually, in some ways, I like their way better, and I just have to, you know, it might be an effort, but it's worth it. And other places where I say, okay, here's where I'm drawing the line. I don't care if you like it. You know, this is the way I am. You know, creating that synthesis took a while. At this point, I feel pretty comfortable here, although I will say that I'm still in the honeymoon phase because we just moved back, and my experience is that the first 3 months are always like, oh my god, I don't have to drive. I can just bike everywhere. Did you see those cute little bike lights? You know, I've got the whole sort of being in love with, like, you know, the
traffic lights for bikes.
And everything elegant. And I get to, you know, bike down the hill, turn at the bike light, get off at the field, play rugby there across from, like, the church with the cows, you know, and then, like, 5 minutes away is like the train station where you can get, like, you know, where you have like these super, you know, high tech, you know, the trains are very, like, very elegant, high tech, user friendly. And then there's all these, you know, like, quaint little cows and stuff everywhere. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, a nice amalgam. You don't have to choose between, like, high tech efficiency and convenience and sort of, you know, quaint, you know, I don't know, nature and whatever. They're all sort of, you know, marbled together. And it's all these things I love. And then I'm sure that, you know, 6 months from now, I'm going to be going like, oh, nothing is open on Sunday. You know, nobody gets the joke, you know. So there's going to be things that are definitely frustrating.
right.
But, yeah, it's interesting. I think it's given me and our family an interesting perspective. This move is big because for the kids, you know, this is my son's first move and my daughter's second move transatlantically. And, you know, they're being immersed in the language and everything.
Yeah.
But they seem to be having a pretty good time.
Because I remember you had a lot of very entertaining stories in your blog when you first moved back to the U.S. With Aviva about her sort of language adjustments. And
right.
Was it, didn't she had an imaginary friend? She would claim not to know any English, but had an imaginary friend who was fluent?
Yes, exactly. Well, it was a doll, actually.
Oh, a
initially,
doll. Okay.
We would speak to her through the doll because she didn't speak in English, but the doll spoke English. So she would hold the doll up and speak English through the doll. And then she would, and she was boycotting English, and she actually was, you know, it was touch and go there whether the entire Washington area would, like, convert to German or whether, you know, she would have to start speaking English because she's got a very strong will. So I wasn't quite sure which way it would go. But anyway, it's funny. My son is currently not. He's not boycotting Swiss German. He's interested in acquiring it, but he's, you know, he doesn't. He can only take so much of it at a time, but. but he likes to show off when he's got it. So, and it's very cute. What else is on your list?
What else is on my list? Switzerland, rugby, and then I was going to ask you what you're reading these days.
Excellent questions.
Take both or either of those.
I'll try to hit both of them. I was almost going to bring up rugby because you were talking about baseball and how it's prone to statistics. And the thing about rugby is that so it seems like it's so not designed for statistics.
Because the part of the reason why I think baseball is so lends itself to statistical analysis is it's kind of a stylized game. Like, you always know where people are going to be and what they're going to be doing. And I feel like rugby is nothing like that.
It's entirely the opposite. And I mean, American football is sort of what you get if you take rugby and optimize it for statistics and, like, for generalship, you know? I mean, because the difference between rugby and American football. Well, it's in American football, whenever anything interesting happens, you stop and line up again. I mean, so rugby is like, that's just when it gets fun. Somebody dropped the ball. Wah! You know, somebody missed that pass. So whoever gets there first, wah! You know. It's funny. I didn't play rugby for 4 years, but I happened upon rugby when I was 29 and fell in love with the game. And so I'm forever never going to be a good rugby player because I started way too late and I'm really small and I'm not that fast. So, you know, I just love the game. So, I mean, it's just so much fun.
Do you get beat up a lot? I mean, injured a lot?
Yeah, you know, I get my, you know, I get like bruised a lot, but I don't actually have very many like big injuries, knock on wood, in rugby. And I think, you know, that may just be purely luck. Or it may also be, I think that I'm, I don't know, it may just be sort of, I like falling down. You know, so I like slamming into things. There's some way in which most of life is so very polite. You know, I'm very like not aggressive. Like, you know, I would never go like go and get into a fight. There's not a lot of things going bang in my life. So it's very fun in rugby to be like, you know, all of a sudden it's a different space where like a whole different set of rules is available. Like you can knock people down and they can knock you down. And I just find that fun. So I think maybe I wonder whether, you know, you might. It seems to me that there would be a certain physiological argument for, like, the more relaxed you were about getting tackled, the less likely you were to injure yourself. So, and I basically, you know, usually my, I mean, it's interesting because the first time I went out for rugby and the first time I got tackled, I remember, like, being, you know, knocked over by someone huge and falling on the ground and having the wind knocked out of me and going, I'm dead. This is it. I'm dead. Oh, my God. I'm dead. I just died. And then I was like, wait, no, but I, you know, I must be severely injured. And I was like, no, actually my body is fine. That's actually just entirely a story that I'm telling myself, because this is so way out of the range of like usually. And I think, of course, it's the context, because usually if somebody like poked me in the thigh with an umbrella, I'd be like, ow, that really hurt.
Yeah.
You know, in life. But in rugby, I could like be, you know, knocked to the ground by a 200-pound guy and be like, all right, let's go. You know, what's next? Yeah. What you got? You know, I mean, because it's just a different context. And so, you know, you realize, you know, the graph of like where you are in terms of like which sensations are coming in and like how you interpret those is just, you know, just it's fascinating to see how that's subject to context. So that, you know, I don't know, it's like I must be getting hurt a lot, but I always come home from rugby and I'm like covered with scrapes and bruises and I'm like, wow, I wonder how those got there. So what was the other thing you were gonna ask?
You know, just I feel like this is a good sort of closing out podcast kind of thing. You know, what are you reading these days?
What am I reading? I am well, you know, one of the great things about I very cleverly arranged for David Moles to move here when I before, you know, as my vanguard.
Right.
I guess he was part of wherever he was, and you know, so I was like, dude, go in Basel. So he's been in Basel, and so I've been basically reading his library now. the like 50, you know, 52 50-pound bags each. So there was like really bare essentials. I brought with me a couple of books, actually. Stars in My Pockets Like Grains of Sand by Samuel Delaney. And, I just read Molly Gloss. What's the one with the Quakers? They go, they it's like Dazzle of the Day.
Okay.
It's a very fun book. There was this interesting whole debate recently on Charlie Strauss's blog about how, you know, whether we would ever in fact colonize space. And you know, he was basically saying, you know, that if you really do the math, there's just no, you know, reasonable reason that a society, there's no possible economic good to be gained. It's not that his main point was, it's not analogous to like the founding of the Americas, which is kind of always, you know, or the European invasion of the Americas, which is always sort of the or for that matter, the Native American, you know, original intrusion into the Americas. You know, none of these analogies work, because it's not like, oh, look, there's lots of game here, or, oh, look, we can ship this stuff back to our home country. It's so far.
Yeah.
So there's no sort of economic good to be had by trade, which would possibly justify this mass expenditure, was his argument. But, you know, I mean, you know, until the point where we get like science that's, you know, Clarkian magic, like, wow, we just all upload and turn it a little, you know, cloud gas or whatever. But like, you know, moving people in their physical bodies there, that's crazy. But, you know, I think that's probably, there was a lot of what he said that was true as far as it goes. But there was a way in which I think the one good that is actually linearly increases with distance is being far away from other people. Mm-hmm. You know, so and so what you get, it seems to me not at all, it seems like there's a certain conflation of like, well, it may not be a good idea, rational thing for a society to expend its energy on, but for people who want to get, you know, get very far away from everybody else. So I thought that Molly Gloss's Dazzle of the Day is a really great book, and it involves this whole sort of society of Quakers who buy used after like a crash of a kind of an economic boom involved in like colonization, which doesn't work out. They buy cheap, like a whole like rotating interior asteroid world, and they get really good at creating a sustainable like biosphere in there. And then they like, you know, set off in no particular hurry, you know, in Generation Ship to like get to the world. And it's very well done, because in Generation Ship stories, you know, often are sort of like, well, we're enduring being in a Generation Ship so that we get to the planet. But really, basically, they fall in love with their little asteroid, and they're really freaked out when they get to the planet, because they're like, why do you want to go out there, you know? And it's very well done. And it's nice to see. It was a great portrayal, too, of like, I mean, I like Quakers. Who doesn't? It's a great portrayal of like a positive portrayal in science fiction of like religious liberals, where they were sort of like, you know, really thought about what God wanted, except their version of God wanted was like that they would sit around quietly until they had a good idea. So anyway, other than that, there's a couple of books I brought with me, and then I've been reading David Moles' library. There's lots of things where he says, oh my God, you haven't read this? And then I have to read it. Like Foucault's Pendulum. I'm reading Foucault's Pendulum. Because he's like, you haven't read Foucault's Pendulum? yes.
I just read that for the first time last year.
Really?
Yeah, and see, it's interesting. I was reading it while I was hitting the point in my last year I was teaching the history of science in the pre-modern world, and I was reading Foucault's Pendulum right around when I was hitting the part of the semester I was talking about magic in Renaissance Europe,
right?
So it was sort of there's this weird reflection thing going on. Uh-huh. And then one of my students saw me on the bus on the way into campus reading it and thought it was very funny.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. You know, I speak a little Italian. Mm-hmm. Enough that I can like get along in conversationally in Italian, but not enough that I can really read that well. So I mean, I read Italian, but it's slow. So the problem is that I mean, it's really fun to like when stuff my stuff is translated into Italian to read it. I can read it, but you know, it's hard to get through. But the problem with that is that whenever like so a lot of stuff that's great in Italian, like I try to read it, I'm always like I'll read it in Italian, but it never happens. And then when I read the translation in English, I'm like, if I compare it, you know, set page by page, I'm like, oh, so much is lost. But you know, what are you going to do? I can't actually read it. So I gave in, and now I'm reading it in English. Right. You know, you should give me some opportunity to pimp my collection, which is coming up.
Oh, that's right. Well, I was going to talk about that in the intro to be recorded later, but you can talk about it now, too.
It's really great to do a collection with Small Bear Press. They're so much fun. We don't know what it's called yet. They just did an announcement where they said, an as-yet unnamed collection by Ben Rosenbaum. So, and then many people suggested that we have that be the name. Which I think would be kind of cool, but no, I don't think. I think it has to be X and other stories, and which means you have to pick the story that is like the emblematic story.
Does it have to be that?
I don't know that it has to be that, but like if not, it has to be really, really. You have to have a really, really good reason for it not to be that, because that's very, I guess, comprehensible, and like people will know. Oh, it's this. And
I guess it is kind of standard to name a collection after one of the stories in it.
It seems to be, which is something of a surprise to me. And I think it may serve a function, like of sort of setting it up for people. Like, I mean, I think there's a sort of an art to it where it's kind of like, okay, use this story as the linchpin of how to interpret the rest of this. Like if you think about, you know, think about it through the filter of this story. And I think that's why it's hard to pick one, because you're like, oh, which story do you want to, I mean, they're so different.
Yeah, you have to
pick
one.
They're all children.
Yeah, like which one of them is going to be the best representative?
Yeah, and or it depends on how you spin it. And my stories do seem to have a lot of, like one sort of qualm I had about having a collection is that I have a sort of a number of different like kinds of story that I write, which I'm not sure that people who are fans of one are necessarily fans of the other. Although I think I guess I've been pleasantly surprised that people do tend to like arrange. But it's interesting how different stories attract different fan bases. The Book of Jashar, which we published, has a totally different fan base than the entire rest of my fiction. I never hear about it from anybody who likes the rest of my fiction, and the people who email me about it are all like, so do you have the actual Book of Jashar?
We get comments on our forum to that effect. It's people who seem to have found Strange Horizons, not for any interest in science fiction, but because of this sort of biblical search.
But sort of, in a way, I feel like that's the, like perhaps that's the proper audience for that story. It might be more fun for them than for, you know, for science fiction writers, there's kind of a, you know, well, that's kind of a cool gag. It's like a vampire set in the Bible, you know, whatever. But like, I don't know, if you actually really are really into and get all the allusions, like that story is carefully like, well, let's see, what I'm writing that story, I was also like, okay, so could we plausibly have this event happen between 2 Kings 14 and, you know, so obviously it's, you know, the readers who are going to get all that are a different, potentially different group.
And you also have a one of the many reasons that I wanted to interview you for the first podcast interview is that another story of yours published in Strange Horizons, The House Beyond Your Sky, is up for a Hugo Award this year.
Yes, indeed it is.
I'm guessing, are you going to Japan for,
I am
for
not.
WorldCon? I
just moved to Switzerland. Yeah. So that would be a little too
That's
much
what I figured. But have you chosen someone to, you know, hypothetically give your acceptance speech?
Yes, I think I have.
You don't have to tell us who it is, but
I'm trying to remember. Again, I think it's Paul Melko, but I might be wrong. Okay. I don't know. I emailed somebody at some point who was going. It was like, hey, do you? Because Paul is up for a couple of awards, so I believe, yeah, like, why not give him another chance to go up on stage?
Yeah.
But or you know, give him more room for more Hugos in his luggage.
Right.
But no, if you recall, there was the whole discussion of how the Hugos this year have like only one woman nominee. And then somebody did a I think I saw on Gwenda Bond's blog there was somebody else had done it, but there was like the regender.org regendering of the of the Hugo list, so that it was all women, and that was really funny. So then I went and read the regendered story by Betty Rosenbaum, the housekeeper's guy, which is a totally different story, which actually was kind of unsettling. I actually realized reading it regendered, I actually realized how, like, it was a kind of a shocking experience, because I realized there was a lot of kind of unexamined sexism in that story, really. I mean, there's a lot of sort of stereotypical, you know, moves, you know, that I mean, which, you know, just natural, but I mean, that's the way sexism operates. It seems natural, right? But I was just like, well, of course it's a, you know, a little girl, and, you know, the bad guy's this guy, and, you know, that's, yeah, it's just, it's sort of, but if you read it regendered, you're like, oh, that's really different. Anyway, so but when the story was up for the British Science Fiction Award, Anna Ferrulia del Don, who lives in England, was going, and so she was going to accept it, and then we had how a whole thing worked out where she was going to accept it as Betty Rosenbaum. But I don't think I'll make Paul do that for the Hugos, because, you know,
so
any other thoughts, probably, questions?
No, I don't think so. I think that was it.
Cool.
Is there anything else you want to say?
I had a history of science question.
Really? You can ask. It may not end up in the podcast, but
no, I don't think it should end up in the podcast. We could formally declare the podcast over.
Okay. Well, if we're going to do that, we should do the thank you for being on the podcast. I'm not good at the intros or the outros, apparently. So.
Well, I mean, and I figure you'll edit things. But, you know, you probably should say thank you and goodbye, because you'll feel even sillier rehearsing that recording that without me there, won't
That's
you?
True. That's true. So we'd like to thank our podcast guest, Ben Rosenbaum, whose story, The House Beyond Your Sky, is nominated for a Hugo Award this year, and we wish him the best of luck. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
This was great.
And you know, I am eternally in your guys' debt for so many excellent instances of editing and such support.
Thank you, guys. That's very sweet. And that concludes the podcast interview with Ben Rosenbaum. I don't think I have a lot else to add here, other than to say that we'll have links to a lot of relevant things up on our website, including details about the Anthroptic project and art show, links to the blogs and books that were mentioned during the podcast. And we, of course, welcome your emails and commentary. You can email podcast@strangehorizons.com. We look forward to hearing from you, and talk to you next time.